and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for September 25th, 2009. I'm Robert Tretterick. This week, challenges for carbon capture and storage, the universality of human correspondence patterns, and establishing the link between nutrition and violence. All this and more, plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about alcohol and risky behavior, from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Once people agree and or a government decides that the level of carbon dioxide emissions is a problem, the next step typically is passing some resolution to reduce those emissions. Now, an obvious first choice in reducing carbon emissions is to capture and store carbon dioxide produced by one of the biggest emitters, power plants that burn coal and or other fuels to generate electricity. In a special section on carbon sequestration in this week's Science, Stuart Hazeldine asks, how green can black be? Hazeldine argues in a review for urgent action to overcome the technical and political hurdles that remain for carbon capture and storage, which limit the potential role carbon capture and storage can play in reducing the effects of global climate change. I spoke with Hazeldine from his home in Scotland. Hazeldine is a geologist at the University of Edinburgh.
What we're looking at here is carbon capture and storage. That's a way of the industrialized world burning coal and gas, but capturing the emissions. Instead of dumping that in the atmosphere, we can store them underground. And that means we can carry on with our good lifestyle while we try and sort out better ways of producing energy.
Of the current methods of carbon capture and storage underway, is there one that's the most popular in terms of the number of demonstration power plants being built or planned, or in terms of the total planned investment?
Well, there's three types of carbon capture which are in the running at the moment, and the two most popular are what's called post-combustion capture, which is passing the gas, instead of going up through a chimney stack, passing that flue gas through a solvent which catches the carbon dioxide, strips it out, and then we can pipe that away. That's got a lot of interest and investment and potential investment because you can fit it onto existing power stations or onto new power stations. And that's potentially quite flexible in the way it works. The second one is what's called pre-combustion capture, and that's where you take a fuel like coal and you can turn that into a gas by heating it, or you can use natural methane gas and you split that gas chemically into carbon and hydrogen and then just burn the hydrogen and take the carbon away as carbon dioxide. That's also pretty popular because that's a lot more proven at the size scale of power plants, but it's much more expensive to build a power plant. But on the other hand, it looks as though it could be more efficient when it's operating. So really, companies are choosing what fits their portfolio best and what looks most likely for them in their particular geographic niche.
What's the third method, and why isn't it receiving much attention?
Well, the third method is what's called oxy-fuel. And that is extracting the oxygen out of air or removing the nitrogen from air, whichever way you want to look at it, and then burning the powdered coal fuel or the gas fuel in an atmosphere which is much richer in oxygen so that you end up just with carbon dioxide and water as the products from that. So it's very easy to separate carbon dioxide from that just by cooling the water. That's very popular and it could well be a much better method, but it's slightly further behind in the technology development race. But it's only maybe 3 or 4 years behind, and the companies which are developing that have got some pilot tests up and running just now, and some of the manufacturers are saying that they'll have that ready for guaranteed sale in 2014 or 2015. So none of these three technologies, oxy-fuel, post-combustion, or pre-combustion, are obvious all-out winners, and it's quite possible we'll end up with a mix of all three in different places around the world.
Assuming then for the moment that carbon capture proceeds, what about the technical challenges of storage? And let's start with transporting the carbon dioxide after it's been captured.
Right. Yeah. So as you say, it's actually usually going to be pretty unlikely that we're burning the coal or the gas exactly at a site where we can store the carbon dioxide. because power plants have been built near to centers of people, and they're not necessarily on top of sites of good geological deep storage. So the pipeline connection is usually what's considered the link between those two. And in the United States, there's lots of experience, 30 years of experience with pipelining carbon dioxide to produce extra oil, to inject that carbon dioxide into the ground to help oil to come out. And a lot of that's already known, and there's some experience of that. Though I have to say the experience in the UK is that the American companies haven't been very forthcoming with their information to help other people design comparable pipelines. But that still needs to be converted slightly for power station use, because if we start pipelining carbon dioxide with impurities in it, then you want to keep all of that mixture of carbon dioxide plus impurities as a liquid. And that means running it at a higher pressure through the pipeline, maybe 10 or 15 atmospheres higher pressure than you would do with pure carbon dioxide, to make sure that you don't get any separation of the fluids as you go through. A fluid changing into gas would be a bad idea, for example. But overall, there's most of that's known, and it's really perfecting and finessing what's known already.
Now then, to the actual storage. What are the different options for storing carbon dioxide underground, and are there different considerations in actually injecting the carbon dioxide itself?
Yeah, underground, there's a whole variety of different storage types, and that's sometimes a problem to communicate because most ordinary citizens don't have a daily experience of the underground like people in the hydrocarbon industry or the water industry have. But there are perhaps three different types of sites which you could look at, which are being investigated. Firstly, there's depleted oil fields where we've extracted oil from an underground accumulation. And that's a question then of injecting the liquid carbon dioxide to try and replace the oil which has already been produced. The second type of storage underground is to look at depleted gas fields. And that's where you've taken natural methane gas out from a pocket of gas in microscopic pore space in the rock underground. And that's drawn down the pressures of that gas field because the gas has been taken away. But there's a slight glitch in that if you're trying to push high-pressure carbon dioxide into a low-pressure gas field underground, that carbon dioxide then expands from high pressure into low pressure, and as it expands, it cools, rather like when you let off a fire extinguisher, that cools the fire extinguisher because the gas is expanding. If that happens deep underground, that can be a problem because that can form a hydrate ice of carbon dioxide ice, which blocks up the borehole. So there needs to be a bit of extra technology work around that. The third type of storage underground is what's called saline formations, and these are bodies, volumes of sandstone rock, which are rather like drinking water aquifers, where the water is held in the pores between the sand grains, but these are maybe a kilometer or 2 kilometers down, and the water's salty, so there's no known use for these saline formations. And in those, there are perhaps 90% of the opportunity for carbon capture and storage, perhaps 9 times more volume than the oil fields or the gas fields. And those are being practiced, tested for injection. And what has to happen there is the carbon dioxide is injected under pressure, but then has to physically compress the water to push that saline water out of the way to allow itself in. And then that carbon dioxide gradually over a period of tens or hundreds of years dissolves in that saline water to make saline fizzy carbonated water effectively. And then once it's dissolved, it's locked up there for geologically long periods of time and very safe.
Now to the political challenges too. What do you argue is the first step? What would be the first regulation to put into effect in order to get these planned carbon capture storage activities to proceed?
Well, the first regulation which has to be in place is that people have to agree that carbon dioxide is a problem. And once a country's decided that it wants to get on that trajectory, then carbon capture and storage moves up the agenda very, very rapidly, because carbon capture and storage is a way of doing very big reductions in the next few years, as long as we can make those pilot plants happen to prove that to power companies. Once you've decided you're on that trajectory, then a country has to decide who owns the pore space underground, the microscopic pores which are going to hold the carbon dioxide. And then you have to produce some rules and regulations around how to set up a licensing system to purchase or lease rights on that block of land underground. And then you have to have a system for giving out a license monitoring that license by the Environment Protection Agency or by the federal government, and then what the conditions are for closure of that license after maybe the 30 years or 40 years of injection life of that storage facility, who takes responsibility for the long-term carbon dioxide and at what stage. And obviously, any government doesn't want to take responsibility if there may be a serious risk. So there's still a conversation in many places going on around how much monitoring, how much testing needs to be done to give that good quality assurance so that a government can take over the long-term liability.
Along those lines, is there anything in particular about either carbon capture, carbon transport, or carbon storage that might prompt members of the general public to say, not in my backyard?
Okay, so there's two answers to that, of course. And technically, as a scientist, I'd say I've got extremely good confidence in this as a set of technologies, because carbon dioxide doesn't burn, it's not poisonous, it's actually much less dangerous than shipping around by pipeline and moving around in a factory. It's much less dangerous than moving a lot of highly flammable hydrocarbon gases like natural methane gas, which we're very accustomed to pipelining around the country. But of course, there's a perception problem, and something new is often viewed with suspicion, especially if a developer or a company comes into a town or a community and tries to propose a development without giving out adequate information.
How is this going to play out at Copenhagen, the new version of the Kyoto Protocols?
So Copenhagen is a crucial point for the world to come together to decide what the world community wants to do about environmental emissions and environmental standards. And carbon capture and storage could be a really big part of that in the future. And some of the estimates are that carbon capture and storage could on its own reduce 20% of the emissions in the future. But it's unclear at the moment that enough countries around the world are aligned behind this banner. So some countries in Europe, UK, Norway, Netherlands are happy to do this. Canada's happy to do this. Australia's happy to do this. United States has maybe started a bit late, but is rapidly moving along this track. But it's unclear that many other countries are sharing this vision, and it's unclear that the United States is going to be ready to contribute its full muscle at Copenhagen. And that would be a pity, because what's needed for this to work is the progressive emergence of carbon pricing around the world to give the waste carbon a value, a penalty value. And it's only by giving the carbon a penalty value and gradually rolling that out across the world that this cleanup will gradually emerge and gradually sweep through the world.
Stuart Hazeldine, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Stuart Hazeldine of the University of Edinburgh writes on the technical and political challenges for carbon capture and storage. Read his review and the whole special section on carbon sequestration in this week's Science. The American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of February 2009 included a mandate to ensure access by everyone in the U.S. to broadband internet capability. Now, the U.S. Federal Communications Commission, or FCC, is proposing that, as part of that effort, that the government actively police internet service providers. Here with more about it is Policy Forum editor Brad Weibel.
Julius Genachowski, chairman of the FCC, proposed on Monday that the government play an active role in policing the internet to ensure that service providers do not slow or outright block access to certain content and services. Service providers would be required to provide clear explanation of how they manage internet use and also to ensure access regardless of the technology that's used to access the internet. This principle of network neutrality has been advocated by consumer rights and media groups and was emphasized as a key component of President Obama's recent strategy for innovation and sustainable economic growth. The continued health and growth of internet commerce and communication, these groups argue, depends on the ability to exchange information as freely as possible, regardless of the content or users. But many groups, including some major service providers, argue that increased regulation of the internet may not be so sensible, pointing to several potential problems. Bandwidth is a finite resource, so ensuring unfettered access to all types and sizes of content may severely impact efforts to manage network speed and efficiency. Thus, some argue that rather than policing the internet in this way, the public would be better served by government investment in better networks. These FCC proposals are part of a larger effort to create a national broadband plan by February 17, 2010. More information can be accessed and public comments posted at www.openinternet.gov.
That was Policy Forum editor Brad Weibel with a policy update from Science and the AAAS Center for Science, Technology, and Congress. When you get a letter, do you write right back? What about when you get an email? According to research by Dean Malmgren and colleagues, the mechanisms that drive people to correspond with one another have little to do with whether a person has received a letter or an email. Instead, the team reports in a paper in this week's Science, our correspondence is governed by the daily circadian cycle, the weekly cycle of human activities, and the propensity that once we've written one letter or email, we are, to some degree, likely to do so again. In other words, the mathematical model with those three parameters is universal, whether you're talking about letter writing or emailing. It's just that the parameters that fit you into the model, the time of day and week and frequency of your actual letter writing and emailing, are unique to you. Malmgren and colleagues further suggest that all human activity is, in this way, universal. And so the research may have applications from increasing our understanding of how diseases spread across populations to a better understanding of how some people are so productive and why. I spoke with Malmgren from Northwestern University in Illinois.
In previous research, we had studied email correspondence of on the order of 400 people from an email archive that was from a European university. And we found a reasonably good model that's able to predict or approximately predict when people send email. And so we were wondering if the same was true of letter correspondence. And we focused on the letter correspondence patterns of 16 historical figures, including Albert Einstein, Sigmund Freud, and Charles Darwin. Now, what's interesting is that there had been some previous work that suggested that the mechanisms that govern when somebody sends letters versus when they send emails is completely different. And since email came after letter correspondence, you might think that people have fundamentally changed over time. But what we're actually seeing is that the letter correspondence patterns are exactly the same as what you see with email correspondence, suggesting that really nothing has changed, but our intuition is now kind of more solidified by the same model.
Has this kind of modeling been used to describe other systems?
There have been some other contexts for models that are similar to ours, but never really in this context. Other contexts are pretty abstract, and they don't really talk about a particular situation, and they arise in areas like industrial engineering, computer science, and fundamental statistics. Really, this model has never been used to describe human activity patterns. Similar ideas have been proposed in computer science and statistics and industrial engineering, but never applied in this particular situation. So in some ways, we are taking these ideas and applying them to a new situation, but in others, the way we're using those ideas is very unique. It's really building on those models. It's not simply taking them, cutting and pasting.
So yielding then a new mathematical tool for describing human activity.
Yes.
Okay. So you're looking at letter writers and emailers independently, not people who do both letter writing and emailing. Does that mean different parameters and models? So one model for emailers and one model for letter writers?
That's a good question. No. We are looking at both emailers and letter writers, but we summarized how these people send communications with the same model, but with distinct parameters for each individual. So Albert Einstein sends letters with a different frequency than, say, Charles Darwin. And that's what distinguishes them, is the parameters of the model, not the model itself.
And then each of the 400 emailers as well had different parameters, too.
Correct.
Did the parameters cluster then in some way, so that the parameters of the emailers were more like parameters of other emailers and parameters of letter writers were more like parameters of other letter writers?
That's a good question, and it's something that we've looked at in another paper where we studied on the order of 6,000 email correspondents from an American university, and we examined how their parameters might actually characterize their behavior or characterize their email activity. Do they cluster in space? Yes, there are some distinct clusters, but identifying how many clusters there are is a very hard problem, and it's one that we're still working on.
Okay. And so what then about the process of human correspondence is universal? What is the universal driver or drivers for human correspondence?
For from a mechanistic point of view, there are three kind of fundamental things about human correspondence and we think human activity in general. The first is that we typically sleep during the same periods every day, and as a result, we have daily cycles of activity. We also work typically during the same days of the week, and so we have weekly cycles of activity. And the third thing is that we typically have some task repetition. So once you send one email, we're much more likely to send several more in succession as long as we're sitting there. And the same is true of letter correspondence. And we believe for, say, shopping or running errands or calling a friend on a phone.
So the daily cycle, the weekly cycle, and the idea of once you've started doing something, you're going to continue along with that task for a certain amount of time.
Right.
Those are the three universals for all of human activity. Is that the idea?
That's what we hope. We've only been able to test it on communication so far because there are really good records, but we hope to show that that's actually true for lots of different activities.
What other systems will you be testing in the future?
Led you right into that one, didn't I?
Absolutely.
Well, one area that we're looking at, for example, is web activity, so the time between clicks on your browser. Another area that you can imagine doing this for and that people have already done or started to do similar analyses for are Unix command prompts. I've also seen stuff for checking out books from the library or how frequently traders actually make trades.
So this model could have some ramifications even in the financial sector, potentially.
Possibly. We certainly hope that we can use our model to better understand financial transactions and finance in general, but there's not very much data that we've had an opportunity to look at yet, so it's pretty early to say something along those lines.
Dean Malmgren, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dean Malmgren of Northwestern University is lead author of a paper on the universality of human correspondence activity. For decades, researchers have been investigating the apparent link between proper nutrition and incidences of violence, the idea being that a population of well-nourished people will have fewer incidences of violence than a population of poorly nourished people. Now, to do a proper double-blind clinical trial to establish such a connection, what you really need is a high signal-to-noise ratio of violence, meaning, well, lots of violence. In this week's issue, science correspondent John Bohannon reports on one such ongoing clinical trial and the population that scientists are studying, people in prison.
I visited the UK's most violent prison. It's Polmont Prison in Falkirk, Scotland. And I spent the day interviewing murderers and scientists. And what was happening there was the largest ever double-blind clinical trial of the effect of vitamin supplements on behavior, in particular on the incidence of violence. Because this is such a violent prison, they have a very high signal-to-noise ratio, which is really important in these kind of studies. On average, typically, there are about 2 violent incidences per day. And recently that's gone down to about 1. And the question is whether that reduction in the frequency of violence is because a large number of the prisoners are receiving these vitamin supplements. However, they won't know until the very end because it's double blind, which means not even the researchers know which prisoner is getting the real vitamin supplements versus the placebo. And they'll let us know what happens in 2012.
What's the evidence, if any, for testing such a hypothesis that vitamin supplements or diet is linked to violent behavior in the first place?
Well, the evidence for this goes back 3 decades. There have been studies of not only prisoners, but also school children, where they do interventions. They give people one kind of diet or another, or vitamin pills or not. And there's plenty of evidence that it has an effect on antisocial behaviors and violence included. But for a number of reasons, a lot of that evidence has been dismissed, either because it wasn't placebo-controlled, or the data was too messy, or the experiment wasn't well designed. And another reason is political. In America and elsewhere, there is this get-tough-on-crime mentality, which motivates a lot of policymakers to dismiss the science, and that's frustrated a lot of the scientists who have done these studies.
And is it enough to show the connection, the link, the apparent cause and effect between diet and reduced incidences of violence? Or is this prison study going further to look at how?
It's going a lot further because for the first time, not only is it doing a double-blind placebo-controlled version of this experiment, but they're also doing before and after cognitive and behavioral tests using computers, and they're taking blood samples before and after. And this is really important because if you want to show not only that there is a correlation between diet and behavior, but also show how that works. So literally, which nutrients are missing in someone with bad behavior and are present when their behavior is fixed, then you have to do it this way. You need a big study with all of these tests included. And that's very expensive. And it's doubly hard when you try and do this in a prison because the paperwork is a nightmare.
What nutritional supplements are researchers testing?
About a dozen, all the standard ones for the recommended daily allowances. And they also include essential fatty acids, the so-called omega-3s.
Now, this work is being done in prison, so any results would just be for prisoners, right?
That's right. And that is a criticism that the researchers are preparing for. They know that even if you prove that this works with prisoners, you may not be able to generalize to the population at large. And in fact, some researchers that I spoke with thought that the next step would be to do community interventions. If it works in prisons, then why wouldn't it work with violent and impoverished communities that tend to generate the criminals? The argument is basically, if malnutrition is a big cause of violence, then we need to intervene earlier. However, other people are a little more skeptical because research with vitamins, a lot of research involving vitamins has been pseudoscience, and that has tainted the reputation of a lot of very good scientists in this field.
So the idea then is, if indeed this research, once it's complete, does settle this connection between diet and violence, then extend the study, do it in communities, and perhaps you can keep people from acting out violently in the first place.
That's the idea anyway. Although once you get out into the community, your signal-to-noise ratio goes way down. The nice thing about prisons from a scientific point of view is that you have all the most violent members of your population concentrated in one place with very controlled conditions.
And you said it's cut down the incidences of violence in half, essentially, since the study began?
Well, when I spoke with some of the scientists who are working in Polmont Prison to get the numbers on violent incidences, they mentioned that in the past few months when they had started their study, that number had gone down by about half. But again, it's impossible to say whether or not that has anything to do with the study or if it's just random noise. They won't know until the very end.
And are all the prisoners participants in this study?
No, not all of them, but a significant portion.
John Bohannon, thank you very much.
Thank you, Rob.
Science correspondent John Bohannon reports on an ongoing clinical trial to establish the connection between nutrition and violence. In the online version of the article, find Bohannon's reporter's notebook, which includes some of his personal impressions of his prison visit. Here's a quick preview.
And it's all the more unusual when those subjects are prisoners, where the data that the scientists are collecting is scabs and bruises that they're inflicting on each other.
Finally today, Eric Stockstead, managing editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about alcohol and risky behavior. Eric, what's this story all about?
This story's about the impact that adolescent drinking has on risk-taking or risky behavior throughout life. It's known that teenagers who drink more tend to grow up into adults who drink more as adults and who participate in more risky behavior. The problem is nailing down cause and effect there. So that means, is it drinking that makes you likely to take risky behavior, or is it people who would engage in risky behaviors throughout their life just tend to like to drink as teenagers? So how do you figure out what's causing what? What these researchers did was they turned to rats, and they turned to rats because they could have them be genetically identical. So that rules out any kind of genetic variation between the rats. The rats, they divided into two groups. One didn't get any alcohol, and the others drank pretty much multiple drinks every day.
By choice, what would cause a rat to want to drink some alcohol?
Rats don't actually like to drink, but they got these rats to do that by spiking gelatin. So the rats were interested in the gelatin and ended up consuming the alcohol.
So they had Jell-O shots.
Exactly.
Okay. How did they test then for risk-taking among these Jell-O shooting rats?
Yeah, they had to kind of do a proxy for that. as well. This was one of those classic press the lever tests. It's essentially a gambling situation where instead of a slot machine, they had two levers and they could press one or the other. And the system was set up so if they pressed one lever, they might get a food reward every time. That's a pretty non-risky situation. Press a lever, get a treat. The other lever might not give them a treat, but occasionally they'd get the big ka-ching payoff and get more food. So the question is, do they engage in pressing the risky lever or not? And it turned out that the rats that were drinking, as young rats, they liked the risky lever. What's interesting is that after the drinking stopped, for the rest of their lives, they still liked to gamble for the big food payoff.
So almost as if the early exposure to alcohol changed something about how they behaved.
Exactly. Now the question, of course, the big question here is, can you extrapolate that to humans? Because the human brain is obviously more complex than the rat brain. Not entirely clear yet, but other researchers say this is really fairly strong evidence that, yes, alcohol really does seem to have a significant impact on the developing brain.
Okay, well, thanks, Eric. So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
So let's move from alcohol to ethanol.
Another alcohol.
But this is ethanol, and it's ethanol in the context of energy policy, biofuels. In 2007, the U.S. Congress passed a law that set a target of 36 billion gallons of biofuels that the country would produce by 2022. Now, of that, 15 billion is slated to come from corn-based ethanol. Now, the catch with biofuels is that if you make them out of corn or plants that you're growing on farm fields, then that has other environmental impacts. One big one is that when fertilizer washes off of farm fields in the Midwest, it goes down the Mississippi and into the Gulf of Mexico. That nitrogen and phosphorus has a really damaging effect there.
But this isn't just true for biofuels. This is true for any kind of farming activity, right?
That's right. But if you create incentives for farmers to grow corn so that it'll be made into ethanol, then you tend to get more crops grown as corn. And corn requires a lot of fertilizer. What that means for the Gulf of Mexico is that when that nitrogen and phosphorus ends up in those waters, it feeds algae and bacteria. When the algae and bacterial blooms die, they sink, they decompose, and when they decompose, that pulls oxygen out of the water, suffocating fish, crabs, other life that people like to fish and eat. So already the Gulf of Mexico has large dead zones. So one question was whether producing those 15 billion gallons of ethanol from corn would increase the size of the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. And it's clear from previous research that that is the case. Now, the next question was whether if you produced more or all of the target for biofuels from cellulosic ethanol, whether that would lead to a smaller dead zone. Now, cellulosic ethanol, that you can do with more of the corn plant, including the rest of the plant, not just the corn, and with other plants. So you can really use less fertilizer if you're doing cellulosic ethanol. What they found was you still need nitrogen and other fertilizers to create enough plants to do cellulosic ethanol with. So there would still be a big spike of nutrients flowing into the Gulf, and that the dead zone will in fact increase, even if we meet that biofuels target by only using cellulosic ethanol.
So last one, what's this last story about?
Well, keeping with agriculture, some of the most fertile farm fields in the world are on deltas, and new research is showing that deltas all over the world are starting to sink.
Everywhere?
That's really the new part of this study, is that it took a global look and compiled data from satellite images. They looked at computer models, they looked at how much sediment is flowing down rivers, and took a look at 33 deltas all over the world. And the surprising number is that 28 of those are essentially losing their race with the sea.
So what does it exactly mean for a delta to sink?
Well, in one sense, deltas are always sinking, because the way a delta is built is that when a major river empties its water out to the sea, it's also carrying sediment. And that sediment gets deposited near the mouth of the river, building up a bank of sand until it actually reaches the surface of the water, and then plants grow, and the whole delta can, by that increase of sediment and vegetation, it can reach sea level. At the same time, that seafloor is subsiding, it's going down, and the sediments themselves, under their own weight, are compacting. So there's this essentially a race for the level of the delta to keep up with sea level. And to make it even a little more complicated, sea level itself changes. So with global warming, for example, as glaciers melt, there's more water entering the oceans, sea level goes up, and as sea level goes up, those deltas tend to get flooded. So what this study found was that deltas are now sinking relative to sea level, and that ranged all the way up to 60 millimeters a year for the Po Delta in Italy.
So global warming is having an impact. Is that the only thing that humans do that caused deltas to sink?
Yeah, in addition to human-caused global warming, there are two other big impacts that humans are having locally on deltas. One is when you drill for oil or drill for natural gas and you pull that out of the sediments in the delta, that causes them to compact even further. So you really exacerbate the compaction and the sinking of the delta. The other one is a little further upstream, and that's the engineering of rivers, which we've done a lot of. So build a dam on a river, and you not only hold back water, you hold back the sediment that's flowing down the river. The sediment gets trapped behind the dams. The deltas then get starved of that sediment that they use to build themselves up with. And in fact, right now, that impact from oil and gas extraction and from starving the deltas of sediment, that's the larger impact that humans are having. Who knows if global warming keeps going, whether that might change.
Okay, well, thanks, Eric.
Good to be here, Rob.
Eric Stockstead is managing editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to the science policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the September 25th, 2009 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine with the support of AAAS, the Science Society. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.